Okay, this meeting is called to order, and let the record show that it is about 4 minutes after 3:00, and Representative Fairclough, Representative Gardner, and Representative Seaton and myself, Wilson, are here, and so we do have a quorum to conduct business. And I would recognize the staff today. Kelly Burnett is back after her little accident as our House Recording Secretary, and Sammy Canine is our LIO monitor. And, my committee aide is Becky Rooney. And before we start, please shut off your phones, because even if they're on vibrate, it interferes with the recordings. So if you could do that, we'd sure appreciate it. And let's see. If you're going to testify, make sure you introduce yourself and your affiliation before your testimony. And we do have two bills to present today on our agenda, House Bill 324, low-income housing, and the House Bill 325, teachers and healthcare professionals housing loans. So the presentation will be, and then after that we'll have a presentation on traumatic brain injury, with a focus on returning Alaskan soldiers and veterans of Middle East conflicts. So first of all, we will do House Bill 324. We heard this bill a week ago, and we do have a CS. We listened to what everyone said. We do have a CS, and would the bill sponsor please come forward and explain the CS? Oh, and it doesn't look, that's Brian, is it?
Yes.
Brian Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And going through the CS, there were 4 changes made.
And you know what, Brian, before you get started, okay, just so we don't forget, would someone like to move the version C for it? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move we adopt CS for House Bill 324, version C, for our working document.
Okay, we have that document now before us. And sorry, Brian, I'll let you start in now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first change is on page 3, lines 1 through 13, where behind a listing in subsection 1 through 7, listing of the commissioners and the different folks that are on the council, we added or the commissioner's designee, or in other cases the executive director's designee. So it points out that a commissioner or executive director could designate somebody such as a deputy commissioner to serve on the board. But the second change is also on page 3, lines 21 and 22, where we added that members of the council, it used to be a 2-year term, and that has been changed to staggered 3-year terms. The third change is on page 5, lines 2 through 23, where we added the definition of homelessness. And this is the definition that is, it's quite long, but it's the definition used by the Department of Health and Urban Development, as well as the Federal Department of Education. So we use that definition to try to be consistent with other programs that are being administered. And the fourth and final change is also on page 5, lines 26 through 31. We added transition language that would describe starting out how the 6 public members would begin their terms, 2 with 1-year terms, 2 with 2-year terms, and 2 with 3-year terms. So we would begin them by staggering them so it would work out into the future.
Okay, thank you, Brian. Are there any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we may have discussed this earlier and I have forgotten, but the 80% median income cutoff for the geographic or economic area in which they reside, and the on page 2, lines 2, 3, and 4, that the corporation shall use a median adjusted income for household size as reported annually by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The question I had is, how small an area does the U.S. Department make those designations of median adjusted income, first of all? And since that's, you shall use that, and this is only for those that are 80% below, do we get anomalies if that's reported for a large area and then we have sections that are not pretty homogeneous?
I'm going to ask Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust to come up if I could, and Mark Romick, our planning department director from AHFC, should also be online, that may also be able to answer that question.
Okay. pull up a chair, Jeff, and join us.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the chief executive officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And Representative Seaton, you want to ask me that again when I'm here and on the hot seat paying attention?
Thank you. The requirement is here that that the corporation shall use the assets to do this for individuals at or below 80% of the median income. And then it says that the corporation shall use the median income adjusted for household size as reported annually by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And I'm trying to figure out how small or how large an area those reports are, whether those are, is it the rail belt? Is it by village? Is it by the whole state of Alaska?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I don't know. I'm going to turn around and see if we have anybody here that does.
Okay. Looks like we have somebody.
Looks like we do.
That does know. Come forward, please, and state your name and your affiliation. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, take the lady.
Okay. Vivian Hamilton. Madam Chair, Vivian Hamilton, Communications Manager for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. It is divided by, the state is divided by cities in some cases and regions in some cases. It depends on population. Does that help?
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It does, but I'm trying to figure out if we are going to have anomalous situations where we have these, that you shall use this median adjusted income. That's what you're directed, that's what you're going to use. And whether we get into a situation where we've said that this is directed to do it 80% below the median income, and I'm worried about the median income at 80%, depending upon the area and whether we have homelessness for a region. It seems to be that we're keying this to a median income, which could be quite variable or quite different depending upon what the region is that it's keyed to, and whether homelessness is necessarily keyed to the median income of the area, or 80% of the median income, and whether that's the appropriate figure, or whether that ties the corporation hand in some places where we could have homelessness, but we can't fund that because those individuals aren't. If the median income is really low, we may have homelessness that we cannot fund because they're not below 80% of the median income for a particular geographic area. And that's, Since I don't know, Madam Chair, how the United States Department of HUD sets those median incomes, I can't figure that out. So I guess, Madam Chair, if that can't be answered, I just want to make sure as this goes forward that gets addressed. And if we have two shalls in here that require that this is the only way you can use the money, even if there is homelessness in the area, and then you can't work on that homelessness because HUD happened to have an area that has a median income that is low, we have homelessness. We can't solve it because they're not less than 80% of that very low median income. And so that's my problem that I just kind of resolved. And if it's not a problem as it goes forward, that's fine. If it is a problem, I would just like to make sure it's solved.
Okay. That's a real good question. And Brian, do you have a comment?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I believe Mark Romick, who was central in the drafting of this, is online, and he may very well have an answer to that question.
Is Mark online?
Okay, and he would be with the principal?
Yes.
This is kind of like life.
Mark, are you online, Mark Romick?
Yes, Madam Chair, this is Mark Romick, for the record, the director of the Planning Department for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Representative Seaton, I believe, through the chair, the answer to your question is that the median incomes are provided on a borough-wide basis. So there are, for as many boroughs as there are in Alaska under the census definition, which I think there's approximately 25 or 30, the median income is provided by family size all the way from a one-person household all the way up to an eight-person household. And so, to answer your second question, there shouldn't be any anomalies anywhere in the state, as even if there is a relatively low income in a particular census area, like in the Wade-Hampton census area, all of the folks that we're going to be targeting with this bill will be substantially below that median income figure. So there shouldn't create any problems in terms of not being able to serve anybody that we intend to serve, even down below the 30% preference level.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark. Does that answer your question, Representative Seaton?
I think so. Mr. Jesse has another.
Yeah, Representative Seaton, through the chair. I see, I think, where you're going here. In a very low-income area, there could be homeless individuals whose low income wasn't low enough to get to 30% and below. I think that that's something, and that's part of the reason this bill has the Council on the Homeless still having an advisory role in advising on how this should be operated by AHFC. You know, if that were to happen, I think people would be aware of it, because we would know that there were homeless numbers in that area that we were having trouble aiming at. And remember that that although the bill requires it to be below 80%, the priority is below 30. But the overall goal is to address homelessness. So I think the likelihood of there being significant numbers of people that would be homeless in an area at, say, 75% of median income would be pretty unlikely, because generally 80% of area median income means that you're employed on some kind of a regular basis. It may be minimum wage, but you're employed. But that's certainly something that we would watch as we implemented the trust. And if it turned out to be a barrier, you can bet we'd come back and bring that to your attention.
Well, I can see where Representative Seaton is coming from, and if that would ever be a problem, now is the time to deal with it with the word shall in two different places. Because shall means you will. And may means you can.
Well, Representative Seaton, through the chair, you know, I understand your point. I think it's well taken. But I would stand by the language that's here, because if you say may, then it opens the possibility of expending these funds for people above that income level. And that's the problem we're having now, is the bulk of the resources, our existing resources, are going to people above there.
Okay.
So I think we're better off with this particular fund, which is focused on the homeless, and keeping that mandatory language in there, and then continuing to watch our outcomes over time. Because I think if you put May in there, that got the potential, much more potential in my mind, to obviate the purpose of the fund than your point.
Thank you. And Madam
Follow
Chair.
Up, Representative
Steve. Yeah, and Madam Chair, I wasn't intending to put May in, but I just want to make sure that we don't have, that we do some analysis and make sure that this doesn't, that there are no sections of the state that would be in this anomalous category that would, people would be the target that we were trying for, and we restrict your ability to do that by the way we've crafted the bill. So thanks, Madam Chair.
And I do want to make a comment that Representative Sisna has joined us probably about at least 10 minutes ago. So thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Hearing no questions, then we will move to, do you have any more comments from the sponsor?
No, Madam Chair, just that we will, Representative Seaton, we will specifically take a look at that to make sure that it's not doing what, you know, wasn't intended.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, and then we'll move on to public testimony then. And Paul Kapinski, are you online? Paul Kapinski?
Ma'am, this is Paul Kapinski, Director of Mortgage Operations. I'm here in case of need on the following bill. In case Brian needs a particular technical question or something like that, I did not intend to testify.
All right, then we can go on to Pat Lubbe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pat Lubbe. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. AARP strongly supports HB 324, which would establish an Alaska Housing Trust. There's a stereotype that many of the homeless are chronic inebriates, but bad things and bad luck happen to people and to families that may cause homelessness. Many older persons, especially renters, are burdened over housing expenses. A run of bad luck with high health care costs or even higher than expected utility costs may change someone's status from a renter to homeless. AARP has tracked the number of grandparents raising grandchildren. Grandparents don't expect or plan on raising their grandchildren. The additional expenses and bills related to raising grandchildren can take a renter into the homeless category. But most of the homeless are children. Research tells us about the difficult circumstances faced by children who experience poorer health and may have to change schools, often more than once in a school year. AARP is the world's largest organization of grandparents. We don't want to see anyone's grandchild homeless. HB 324 won't solve our homeless problem, but it will help as we try to resolve this situation for our fellow citizens, especially those little citizens. We can do better. HB 324 will help us get there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions, so.
Yeah.
Oh, Stephanie Wheeler. Okay, Stephanie, I guess she's testified last time. We'll go on to Richard Warrington. Richard Warrington, are you there? I think from Kenai, maybe.
Yeah, the speaker was off the microphone. Okay. Hello, House Committee. My name is Richard Warrington. I was appointed on the ambassador program by the Brain Injury Association of America. I'm a survivor of a traumatic brain injury that happened going on 30 years ago in Colorado, and I'm still disabled from the injury and have cognitive problems. I have lived in Alaska for over 22 years, and I wanted to ask all of you to make sure that no funding is cut that is to do with anything about traumatic brain injury, like the House Bill 324. I know a TBI survivor in Anchorage that he got out of one housing because of the fire, and now he's having trouble trying to find another, and that 324 could help assist other TBI survivors around the state on finding their houses because they need to get readjusted and relearn how to live on their own and halfway houses like they got in New Hampshire. Do any of you have a question for me? I'm short on funding, too, for my own house.
Thank you very much, Richard. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Roland Roland Cabade?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you wanting to testify?
No, ma'am. I'm just listening in, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. And Mark Romick, you did give us a little information. Did you want to add anything more?
No, Madam Chair, not unless anybody has a question for me.
All right. Then we'll go to people in the room. Is there anyone else online that wants to testify? No one else online? Okay. All right. Jacqueline Hardy? No, thank you. Okay. All right. Well, I will close testimony then. Testimony is closed. And do we have any questions or any discussion with the committee? Representative Gardner?
Well, Madam Chair, in the absence of any other discussion, if we're ready, I move. Are you ready? I'll pause.
Oh. Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, on page 3, line 19, just a question technically, and I don't know if we have any legal online, but expertise working with housing development, comma, financing, and consumer of affordable housing. I wonder if that should be or. All four members are supposed to be consumers of affordable housing.
Collectively, they work. Oh. Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I might, the way I read it, it means that of the four of them, there's at least somebody who's worked with housing development.
Yeah, I think
with financing and with the consumers for affordable housing.
Collectively, I think helps that.
So there could be two who've worked with consumers or one who has no such experience, but at least of the four, there is some experience in those three areas.
Okay. Okay. Representative Gardner.
Okay, Madam Chair, if we're ready, I would like to move House Bill 325, Version C, as amended with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, 324?
Excuse me, 324. Yes.
All right. Hearing no objection, committee substitute for House Bill 324, Version C, has been moved from committee. Thank you very much. So don't leave before you sign your individual recommendations. So we will move to the next bill. And that is House Bill 325, Teachers and Healthcare Professionals Housing Loans. And this program was just due to sunset July 2008. I plan to move this bill also today. So, Brian, are you going to make comments on this bill also?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair. For the record, again, Brian Butcher, Public Affairs Director for the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. You're correct, Madam Chair. The teacher and nurses housing loan program, which essentially gives zero down payment loans to teachers and nurses that would qualify under the same criteria that our mortgage department would ever do. It would be good loans, wouldn't go to people that wouldn't qualify for a loan, but the genesis of the program 5 years ago was Senate Bill 25, and the thinking based on a couple of task forces was that communities had been dealing with a shortage of teachers and nurses, not just recruiting them to communities, but also keeping them in communities. And the thought behind it was, if you could get a young teacher, a young nurse who out of college has big student loans and doesn't have the money for a down payment, because for young people the number one deterrent to buying a home is being unable to come up with the money for a down payment, that would then encourage these nurses and teachers, once they bought a home in the community, the likelihood of them staying in the community would be increased. A five-year sunset was put on it, and that sunset expires this July 1st. So thus the urgency for the bill. To give you an idea of the usage of it, since the program was started 4.5 years ago, 373 teachers and nurses have used the program. We've only had one foreclosure. And so AHFC's foreclosure rate is low nationally, but this program is even lower than the rest of our loan portfolio. So it's been very well used. It's been the fear kind of when we discussed it 5 years ago was, well, you have a zero down, there might be more of an inclination for somebody to walk away from the loan. We can see that that has not happened, and that it's been marvelously successful. In discussing it with the governor's office as we worked on the sunset bill, they asked us to expand it from teachers to healthcare professionals, that there seemed to be a need in communities for a lot of the occupations that fall into the healthcare field, a tremendous shortage in many respects. And we were happy to add that. So the two things this bill does is it removes the sunset to keep the program going and expands it from RNs to healthcare professionals.
Okay. Brian, is there you don't have the breakdown between teachers and nurses?
Yes, Madam Chair. In the backup, there should be we passed it out. It should be about, I don't know, a 15-page document that lists by community, and under the column of area, if it has an E, those are the teacher loans. If it has an H, those are the nurses' loans. That's how our mortgage department categorized them for some reason. So you can go community by community. You can see how many teachers, like the top of page one, in Anchorage, 114 teachers have used the program, and 77 nurses have used the program. And the positive is not only are we helping these people get into homes, but this is at no additional risk to the corporation or the state. These are just healthy, full, you know, no subsidized percentage-wise loans. These are just good loans, works for the folks taking them, works for us, and it's just been successful all the way around.
Good. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Can you please sort of define healthcare professionals? I mean, who does it include besides nurses and doctors?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, hopefully I won't muddle this issue too much, but we have a different program that's called the Rural Teachers and Health Professionals Program that's in our capital budget that works with school districts and communities to build rural housing to help recruit and retain teachers to rural areas. And this is kind of, although there are rural loans in this, it's used mostly by urban areas where the more teachers and the more nurses are. And so we had planned to use a definition similar to the definition we use there. And I don't have it in front of me, but Paul Kapansky, I think, who's on, can give you an explanation of specifically what that is.
Paul Kapansky, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am. I'm Paul Kapansky, Director of Mortgage Operations for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The overview of the as far as who would be eligible would essentially be health and medical services and certification and licensing currently in the Division of Healthcare Services. More specifically, as Brian was referring to our grant program, we have health professional housing is defined as housing for any person who is licensed or board certified by the state of Alaska in a health profession, holds a state certification in a health occupation, or is an administrator of a hospital or clinic, or employed as an aide, attendant, assistant, counselor, or technician in a health field. Occupancy of the household is limited to health professionals and family members. Does that answer the question, Madam Chair?
Yes, it does. But I really have a little bit of a concern. Even hospital administrators can do. I mean, you know, they make. Is there no? The reason I question that is because they should be able to afford a down payment, you know. So I'm wondering whether we need to look at that and see. It would be easier to maybe put healthcare healthcare people that are in healthcare in areas where there are shortages or something like that is what I'm thinking of. But
Madam Chair, you raise a good point, and as we looked through this, we thought it should we put a limit on income or something like that, but with the zero down, instead of coming up with 20% mortgage insurance like a traditional loan, this program requires 35% mortgage insurance just because there's more of a risk to the corporation. Alaska Housing is also kind of the borrower of last choice a little bit in the state. We specialize, most of our loans are rural loans, first-time home buyer loans, vets loans. And as a result, that's where most of our specialty is. If you were to go out onto the market in Anchorage just to buy a home, you're probably going to find cheaper 30-year mortgages than Alaska Housing. And so I think if a hospital administrator making $500,000 a year wanted to buy a home, that it would cost them far more in the interest rate over 30 years than it would them not putting any down payment down. So it really is something that if you look nationally, the zero down payment benefits young people that don't have the cash, and it's also used a lot by folks in investment properties where they want to buy as many homes as possible, and so they're looking for that. Well, this program is owner-occupied. You must live in it, so there are no investment properties, so that potential problem's not there.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm a little bit concerned about the expansion of the definition of who's eligible, and here's the thing. If somebody's a nurse or, you know, a dental hygienist that has a certification or a license, that person has an investment in their career. But when we expand it to aides or attendants, I don't know how often those people stay in the field. I mean, maybe somebody's an aide for a year while they're going to school and then goes off and does something completely different. So is there any requirement for ongoing participation in the healthcare field or history of participation, anything like that?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. There hasn't been at this time, and we looked at it at the time when it started 4 or 5 years ago, but looking at trying to track that would be far too labor-intensive for our mortgage department to try to look in the out years whether somebody's staying as a teacher or staying as a nurse. And also, because it is a regular loan with the regular interest rate, you know, it's not like we're subsidizing. I feel like we probably would be willing to spend a lot more money in personnel if we were giving them a 1% interest rate reduction or something, where somebody could become work in the health field for a year, get that subsidy, and then go off and do something else. But all this is doing is helping them get into a home at regular interest rates.
And I've actually worked with a lot of nurses aides, and many of them most of the time don't have the money to go ahead and go on to school to do something else. And so some of them do have homes, though. So I don't think some of them go on and become a nurse or something like that. But I think it would be really great if some of them would qualify for something like that. So any other questions? No more questions. Okay. Well, let's go. We do have somebody online. Representative Faircloth?
Just a point of, do we have a bill before us?
Yes.
I didn't know if we needed to.
Yeah, we do have the bill before
okay,
us.
Thank
and
you.
It's the, you know, it's an original bill.
Thank you.
It's House Bill 325. So, Brian, thank you for your comments. And if you just want to, you can either sit back down or sit right there, because we'll go ahead and we have someone online that would like to comment. So, Nancy Davis?
I'm here.
Oh, I guess that's, let me look for sure. Do we have anyone online? Okay. All right. Come on in, Nancy. Come on up and have a seat. These papers do say, please sign in, but they get confusing sometimes. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
My name is Nancy Davis, and I am a registered nurse, and I'm employed currently part-time with the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health, and I'm working as a coordinator for nurse recruitment and retention. So you can imagine I'm supportive of continuing this bill, and I'll tell you why. I worked also for public health nursing from 1980 until 2005 when I retired as the chief of public health nursing. So I'd like to share with you how this AHFC teacher and nurses housing loan program has helped over the years since it began in 2003 with our recruitment and retention efforts. As I mentioned, we have used this since it started. AHFC information is routinely provided to nurses who inquire about employment, shared with our current employees, and I give them a brief description of the program as well as the two particularly attractive rural housing loan programs that AHFC has. And in our current revisions to our website, we're going to also include a helpful link to this program. So I do hope it does continue. In my long career of recruiting and retaining nurses, it's really always been important to feature any incentives that we might have to attract nurses to our state. In order to meet all the healthcare needs that we have and to meet the employer needs we have, we need more nurses than we can graduate in state. And so we're always looking for nurses to be attracted to our state. Certainly incentives for nurses to live and work in rural areas is a special bonus. So now in the recruiting environment that we have today, it's a competitive situation of a local and statewide and global nursing shortage, very highly competitive job market for all healthcare occupations. Any and all incentives become important in recruiting. I think that the other thing that I've been seeing, certainly with our younger professionals coming out, is an enormous student loan debt that I would have found unimaginable when I graduated from nursing school. With the mortgage climate in the world, the high student loans, the competitive job market, certainly information about attractive and safe loan options for housing becomes even more important, I think, for professionals wanting to establish in an Alaska community. Curiously, I may never know if a nurse even uses this program, but I do know their reaction to the fact that I introduce it and offer it. It impresses them that our state puts a value on attracting health professionals, nurses. So it makes a positive impression on that applicant, and it tells them that Alaska values them and their work, and they're eager to assist them in becoming Alaskans. A nurse who chooses to purchase a home in one of our communities really makes a real commitment to that community as well. There's a sort of an underlying joke. We say that a really good mortgage is the best retention strategy we can always get. So I think that certainly if other health professionals can be well served by housing loan options if AHFC is able to include these additional groups of recipients, it may well help them as much as it's helped nursing. Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Nancy. Any questions?
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Gardner.
Thank you. If you'll indulge me, it's not exactly on the topic of the bill, but I think we'd all be interested in your work. As far as retention goes, what are the top reasons that nurses leave the profession?
I would say the first top reason is age. Nurses are aging out of the workforce rapidly. That's not as fixable. It is fixable in some ways with some job design responses as nurses age, and maybe they are not as able to do 12-hour shifts, and so they back to shorter part-time flexible hours. So I would say age is one. The other is there are many. Nursing is primarily a female occupation still, even though we're having better luck recruiting more men into the profession. It still is predominantly female, and 30, 40 years ago, nursing was one of the few choices that women had for a profession, and now they can become a computer programmer for twice the income, or a stockbroker, any number of, thankfully, any number of occupations. So it's not a, a target field anymore, and it's one of the many things they can do with a college education. So those are two things. I think the other is just employers trying to do everything they can to create safe work environments and respectful work environments and good places to be working. I think those are the three things I would say about retention.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else like to testify on this bill? Okay, we will close public testimony then. And what are the wishes of the committee? Any comments, discussion? Yeah, I'm ready to move it. Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move from committee HB 325, that's 25-GH2027/A, from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Okay, thank you very much. Hearing no objections, so moved. And we are done with our, thank you, with our bills for the today. And we do have, though, now we're going to hear some information on the traumatic brain injury. And so for you that want to present, come on forward. Okay. Just go ahead and take a seat and state your names. And anytime you switch, make sure you mention your name again, because your voices might sound quite the same to someone that's taped something. So,
okay. For the record, I'm Jill Hodges. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Brain Injury Network. And Becky, do you know how to get the computer going again?
Just it seems to be sleeping.
And for the record, my name is Stephanie Tanner, wife of Sergeant Scott Tanner, Operation Iraqi Freedom Vet.
And I wanted to add that Stephanie is from Eagle River. First of all, I just wanted to say this is wonderful how appropriate that the House Bill 324 has come before you at the same time as our presentation, and that we have Richard Warrington online, who is one of our board members. And Roland Caveat is the OEF case manager for the VA, and he's online. So Roland, at any point, if you want to speak up, feel free. I also want to recognize the fact that we do have many of our board members. If you're a board member of the Brain Injury Network, can you raise your hand?
You're welcome to introduce them if you wish.
Okay. We have Martha Moore, Millie Ryan with the Governor's Council, and Denise Daniello with the Commission on Aging. And also the fact that we have the trustees, and wanted to thank Jeff Jesse and Bill Hogan for really bringing light to the issue of traumatic brain injury and the returning service members and planning for them.
Great. Thank you. And go ahead and proceed.
Okay. Before you, you have lots of materials. Was everyone able to receive them and look through them a little bit? And one of the things that you might ask is, why did we send you so much information? And one of the things I did want to ask is, how many people in the room have read an article about traumatic brain injury in the last year? Okay. How about 10 years ago, how many people read an article about traumatic brain injury? Great. Well, Representative Garner and Representative Cisna, thank you for remembering 10 years ago. One of the main points regarding the information that we sent was the fact that traumatic brain injury has been on the table at the federal level and at the state level for several decades, and that the military really has brought in light to the issue of traumatic brain injury. And here in Alaska, as you read in your promising practices for state systems of coordinated services and support, the federal government enacted the TBI Act of 1996. And through that program, the Department of Health and Social Services applied for a federal TBI grant, and they received it in 1999. And so through that program, the state also began surveillance of traumatic brain injury. And mental health centers today are tracking and screening for traumatic brain injury. And what that shows is that the state has made a commitment to finding data. I mean, anecdotally, we've known that there are thousands of Alaskans affected by brain injury. But now we're really beginning to see the hard numbers and the impact, the true cost impact and the social impact that this disability has on Alaska. So one of the main points we want to really share is that this is a full state program or full state initiative, and that we do need support from the roles of the state of Alaska, the role of the community providers, the role of the military, and mostly the role of the individual as well. And we are planning for that. And a lot of this information is in your packet, so I'm going to skip over it since we only have about 15 minutes. But I did want to bring now to the issue of the military experience. And the last few months, the State Department of Health and Social Services, the Trust, and myself have helped coordinate monthly meetings with Elmendorf, the VA, the National Guard, the Wounded Warrior Program, and the Voc Rehab and Employment for VA. And we've really began to discuss what are the roles and really how much impact is this going to have on the state. One of the biggest things that I think I've learned in the last few months is the fact that the military here in Alaska has really responded to this issue. And just back in September, they heard word that there would be 3,200 service members returning to Alaska in the month of December. And if you go off of the national rates of 20% of those may screen positive for TBI, they're guessing maybe 400 or so people all at once would be returning to Alaska with the symptoms of traumatic brain injury. And what they have done is that they have made commitment to traumatic brain injury, and they've made a commitment to have a TBI partnership meeting twice a month on Elmendorf. And in the past few months, they have planned and they've now implemented a mild traumatic brain injury clinic on base. And this group has worked very quickly to make this happen. And this is just a testament that brain injury services here in Alaska are possible. We have the in-state professionals to pull together to help coordinate the services, and that the military really has made a commitment to their returning service members that may have symptoms of traumatic brain injury and their families as well. And
excuse me, have they had enough time since they came back? I know a lot of them were December, but some of them were the first of the year too, so I don't know if they've had time to screen them. But
well, what I've heard is that they go on block leave when they first return. So really the impact is going to be over the next few months, and that's when we'll really see 90 days post-return whether there has been challenges due to a TBI. I also want to mention the National Guard and what they have developed. They have had, let me look on my list here. Oh, they develop grand rounds, and so 90 days after their members have returned, they actually, a group of them, TRICARE, a medical professional, a counselor, the VA, or the National Guard Transition Assistance Advisor, they go to rural Alaska. They go to the family and they ask, have you had challenges? What can we do now? How can we connect you to the VA services that you qualify for? They've also hired family counselors to work directly with the family in the home and act immediately. They've held community forums and mass briefings so that family members understand traumatic brain injury before their family member returns, and they're going to begin doing that with the employment sector here in March. So they're all pulling together, recognizing that we don't know what the exact outcome is going to be of all those returning to Alaska, but we better have a plan in place just in case. Another reason why the Alaska Brain Injury Network comes before you is really because of our mission. And our mission is to educate, plan, coordinate, and advocate for a comprehensive system of care for TBI survivors. And here in Alaska, there are many people driving on roads that are variable and walking on slippery sidewalks, playing hockey, participating in activities that are quite risky. And traumatic brain injury happens often, and it happens at a 30% higher rate than the national average. And that we can have brain injury programs here in the state, and that we will be having a plan for budget recommendations over the next couple of years, and that the department and the Mental Health Trust Authority have been extremely supportive of our organization and supporting the needs of TBI survivors as well. So what we ask you today is to recognize TBI and to support funding in a TBI resolution making March Brain Injury Awareness Month, and to be aware of upcoming years that this is going to be a project like other disability groups that will take a substantial amount of funding in order to have cost savings in the long run. Homelessness and corrections, you'll hear a lot about that in the next couple of years because the trust is highlighting it, and hopefully we'll be gathering some data of how much or how many of those folks have had a hit in their head in a traumatic brain injury. And so now I'd like to really just have Stephanie just be open about her experience and for you to answer or to ask questions, and hopefully we can answer them.
Okay. Me and my husband met in Alaska after his tour in Iraq. While in Iraq, he sustained in excess of 30 IEDs explosions. During the first year of our relationship, I saw him decline rapidly. That's mental capacity, inability to speak, fine motor skills, everything. Between January and May, after months of encouragement to go to the doctors with no success, he did end up getting a diagnosis of TBI, thankfully. But since then, I have assisted him in everything, from driving to appointments and medications. His therapies help. Thank you.
Okay.
His therapies really do help, but thank you. But us as a family have declined because I am the case manager. You know, I tell him when to take his meds. I tell him when to go to appointments and whatnot. Because there is so little case management and medication help out in Alaska, it's really a burden on the families for this. And even with active duty pay and, well, right now we're trying for Social Security, but I don't really know. It's really hard because I can't work. So living on $30,000 in Alaska, I'm sure, as you know, is below income, is below poverty income. And it's such a burden on the families to really get help for their family member. And there's a lot of guys out there with this. And I mean, from our day-to-day life, we just go into therapy twice a week and playing the Medicaid, we call it the medication game, every morning and night. And him, thank you. And he takes, we call them naps, but we really don't know. 2 to 4 hours a day, and he doesn't know what he does during those times. But he is getting better. And that's, I would really like to see a lot, because I know on the civilian sector, there's really nothing out there like this. There's really nothing out there that the Army gives to their guys. And the civilian sector needs something, you know, personal case management, personal medication management, personal escorts to all their appointments and everything they need to do. But there's really nothing out there like that, and there needs to be. And that's why I'm here today, to advocate that and to get that out there.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. We really appreciate you, your willingness to come and testify before us. Can you tell us a little bit, is your husband, can he walk or is he in a wheelchair?
He can walk with assistance of me. He has no depth perception. His eyes don't work in conjunction with his feet or his brain, so he needs assistance. He's too big of a man to use a cane or anything, so I'm always there. But he can kind of walk. He can't bathe by himself. And it takes him a lot just to put on socks and shoes and stuff. Okay. Yeah.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one of the really tough parts on this kind of thing are what happens to the family. And for instance, you're the person who sounds like is kind of the key person. Are there any support groups out there where you can call on the phone or get together and talk through kind of how you're feeling about it and look for suggestions and that kind of thing? Is there anything like that?
There tries to be. They're starting a family readiness group through the Army, for the Warrior Transition Unit, but because it's just so new, and as far as Army standpoints goes, there's no real grounds to grasp, and there's just nothing so far. I mean, I've seen a little through the Army sector, but not as far as on the civilian personnel, no.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna. I would like to add that this is how the military and the community can learn from each other. And there are several civilian head injury support groups around the state. Juno has one of the most active groups, and they were going to try to come today, and a few of them wrote written testimony just to show their support, so I'll pass that to you afterwards. But it's a very much needed resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I would say that in some ways your husband is among the luckiest of this population because he has you and because he has a diagnosis. And I imagine there are a lot of people with milder symptoms who aren't diagnosed and who end up fighting or drinking or in prison or homeless or, you know, this whole range of things that we can read about in these packets and elsewhere. So to me, it seems pretty stunning that you get as little help as you do, knowing that there's a very clear connection between his military service and his disability today. And what does the Army or the federal government say about this? I mean, it seems like it shouldn't be all on your shoulders.
This is true. Because it is, I'm sure you've read the statistics on it on the civilian sector with due to cost, it is it's over in excess of $4 million just to treat, just to go to therapy, and just for all the medications and all the transportation. It is such a costly thing. And so as far as the military is still it's still a business. It still needs to be effective as well as be, you know, empathetic. So they're still trying to do the duty to help out the guys that can work, and they're still trying to help out the guys that are hurt. But as far as the families are second to the guys. So yeah, it would help, but as far as right now, there's really not too much. I mean, they try with their case managers, but there's just so little of them. And if there's so little of them in the military, I know there's so little of them in the civilian sector. So it's I take it upon myself to put so much, but that's just because I know without me he wouldn't be successful.
Do you guys live on base or do you live off base?
We currently live in Eagle River, but because he can't drive, they're making us move on post. So I guess so he could be closer to all his appointments and his units and everything. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I was just wondering, is there any way that once you move on to base, if you could make connections with some other gals that are maybe going, or guys that are going through the same thing that you are,
mm-hmm.
maybe you could have a little group,
yeah,
you know, that you're able to get together once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be I mean, I'm just trying to think of ways to help.
Oh, no. I mean, there are some groups in place, but because taking care of a person with TBI is such a highly demanding thing, it's really hard to find time for yourself.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you ever get any respite? I mean, in other words, do you have other family that can come in and stay with him so that you can just get away for a little while?
Well, actually, I think this is the first 3 days I've had in well over a year. All our family really lives down in the lower 48. We have a couple friends up here. But because everybody's so hurt, all our friends that he's gone through these experiences with, they're all retiring out. So all these guys that are coming back are all really new young guys and all really new young girls. So they're all adventurous to try and help, but it's really just a time-consuming process.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Representative Sisna?
Well, I was just going to say that probably caregiving, and this is true, it doesn't really kind of matter age in a lot of ways. Young mothers face the same kind of problem. Do you have children?
I don't have children of my own. We have five stepchildren through him, yes.
Oh, yay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, all of these things are where you give and give and give and give, and the human body can only do so much. So our chair, focus on you a little time every day and give to yourself because that's one of the things that we do see in caregiving is that there oftentimes are real health loads on the caregiver. And so, you know, to the extent you can possibly work it, I can't believe that there isn't a way to develop some connections out there. Even by phone would be helpful, it would seem to me.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna. I wanted to point out the resource I sent to you, Success Story, Mr. L, and the knowledge that rehab for brain injury is very acute, it's very time-consuming, it happens for about, say, on average, 1 to 2 years. And then after that, we're hoping that they're at a functional level that independence is regained and the family member can step back a little bit from that role. And that after that 2 years, though, it really becomes learning how to live with a traumatic brain injury for the rest of your life. And for a lot of the returning service members are in their 20s, they're going to live another 50 years. And if we can put that energy and that commitment and the funding towards the acute rehab, knowing that further down the line, we could be assisting the family live a semi-independent functional life, and that there are some folks, though, that do not have a family member and that will not be able to live on their own, and that their behaviors really keep them from being able to be productive members of our society, and that there are places in the lower 48 where Alaskans go to live the rest of their lives because of their cognitive disability. And that we met a young man who at age 10, he was on an ATV he's an ATV accident in Kotzebue, and he was flown to Texas for rehab. And he was a gentleman that, he is now a gentleman, he's 26 years old, and he lives in a very supportive, wonderful environment called Live Oak, down in outside of San Marcos, Texas. He's very happy there. He's with other survivors of traumatic brain injury and those with developmental disabilities. And every day he goes to the community gym and works out, and he volunteers at the greenhouse, and he has a very structured day. But this is a young man that has lots of behavioral discontrol. And if he did not have that supportive environment, him functioning out in society would mean approaching women inappropriately, getting into confrontations that he shouldn't be in. And his family recognizes this. And traumatic brain injury is one of those disabilities where without the right supports, you could fall very low. But with the right supports, you could stay at a very functional level that keeps a pretty good quality of life and an enjoyable future to look forward to. And so the plan that you don't always recover and that you are who you are, and you improve just as any other human would improve, and you do become and relearn a life for yourself.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I know that your presentation is focused on military returnees with traumatic brain injury, but looking through some of the documentation about homelessness and substance abuse, and the piece that's kind of missing that I think is also a big threat is incarceration from inappropriate behaviors. And I know I've read studies, I don't remember the numbers, about the percentage of our chronically incarcerated people who have some degree of traumatic brain injury when they're actually tested. That's a very, very common denominator across the board, and that's a threat that I think we'll see mm-hmm. hanging over this community unless we figure out a constructive way today.
Well, there are a few states, through the chair, Representative Gardner, who have approached that subject. Minnesota is one, and Wyoming is another. And they've actually used their federal HRSA TBI grant money to do a 3-year implementation plan for corrections. You know, the first year having a screening process in place, the next year following up with what sort of programs or what sort of treatment should they have while in corrections, and then how to successfully reintegrate them into the community as the third year. And I do know that the percentages that I've read have been in the 80% range for both Minnesota and Wyoming in regards to screening positive for past head trauma. And we have to make sure we keep clear, though, that screening positive for head trauma and having a diagnosed traumatic brain injury are two separate things, and that they're constantly trying to have a test that's valid and appropriate and gets the right data at the same time.
Thank you.
Any other Representative Faircloth?
I just wanted to thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming today. Thank you for being brave enough to share with us. I know that's not easy all by itself, let alone when you've got a load on your back. So I think you're very brave, and we really appreciate that you came today. And I guess we will definitely finish up. I've had a chance to look over this, and I'm going to look over it a little bit better. And, and I really think that the fact that we know that we have a lot of veterans that are going to be coming, we have more. The information that you have inside here tells us how many more Alaska has than any other state, and it's phenomenal. It truly is, and we need. And I'm sure that the federal government is realizing more and more this now too, and down the line, you know, maybe next year's budget or how that works. You know how that works. That they probably will be having more things for families, but like you say, right now they're really behind the eight ball, and they know it, and so they're going to be throwing things into the patients themselves, I know, for a while. But good luck with both of you. And now, do you have the stepchildren at home with you?
Yes.
How many?
Two.
Yes. How old?
15 and 10.
Oh my.
Yes. And my 34-year-old child husband thing.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you said that he really has made improvements. Now, like, for instance, does he talk to you at all?
Oh, yes. He talks to me. His is more, he can make a sentence. He can make it pretty good. It's just getting it out there. when he's upset or frustrated, he stutters quite a bit. But he can make a sentence. When he's more comfortable, it comes out a lot clearer. And also when he's trying to say, it comes out a lot better. But he talks pretty well. Yeah. He's right now, he's in speech therapy, trying to get all that going, the quick responses and the recognition and the memory. His short-term memory is slim to none. In fact, we go over every day what happens and write everything down just to get that process going. But, yeah, he's getting there, hopefully.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that is wonderful. Thank you so much for coming. And do you have any last comments or anything?
We look forward to being in contact, and I hope we can answer more questions throughout the year.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And we will adjourn.